You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. When dealing with strange events and unusual encounters, these incidents can be frightening enough without the need for embellishment or exaggeration. Yet if these occur in conjunction with a thick, menacing fog or a strangely coloured mist, then for the unfortunate witnesses, it seems all bets are off. Returning to Mysteries and Monsters this week is author and researcher W.T. Watson to uncover some of the cases he covers in his new book, Mysteries in the Mist. From mind-controlling mirrors to curious creatures lurking in the shadows, ghost ships and an alleged killer sea monster, the murky mysterious mists hide all kinds of terrors. We'll also meet a man lost in time, a funny yet frightening encounter with a strange cloud, and even a surfer's encounter with a pterosaur, amongst other perplexing cases. But before that, as always, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters for $4 a month. Early release, ad-free episodes and bonus content. And you can also click on the link in the show notes to sign up for $4 a month. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn. And don't forget you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also find information and the episodes, as well as merchandise links, on the website, mysteriesandmonsters.com. Thank you, as always, to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. No matter how bright our torches may shine in the darkness, or how big our bravado may seem, the mysteries of the mist would seem to care not. Often, when we consider supernatural events or strange encounters, they often leave the experiencer shaken. Yet sometimes, even these strange encounters can be taken to another level, when a mist or fog also appears alongside them. To discuss this even stranger aspect of the weird is our good friend, W.T. Watson. Travis, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Paul. I really appreciate the opportunity to, you know, get to talk to your listeners again. We had so much fun with Phantom Black Dogs last time. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
Absolutely. Well, it's always nice when somebody wants to come back, Travis, so I must have done something right.
Absolutely.
I know we were kind of touching on this the last time we spoke back in October, when we were diving into the wonderful Black Dog book that you'd done in regards to that whole pantheon of paranormality that encapsulates. And this is often, I think it was a good bridging point. And I would imagine for someone like yourself, Travis, who dipped his toe into the world of the real paranormal cases out there, once you kind of open the door, I think it kind of slowly begins to pull you through into the other side. And clearly, Black Dogs was the introduction to a whole world of it, because there are so many sort of leads that have come from that book into this one. It seems like for me, looking at that first, you know, full paranormal book, because obviously it was your second book, this seems to be a natural progression in regards to your investigation and correlation of reports.
Well, it really was. You know, Phantom Black Dog book, as I explained last time, Phantom Black Dogs, Walkers of the Liminal Way, was actually an offshoot of a novel that I wrote, which was also published by Beyond the Fray. And, you know, the lead character in that book is actually a shape-shifting black dog. And when I published the book with Beyond the Fray, they asked me, so, you know, do you have any good black dog stories you want to share in a nonfiction book? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, I do. And I went down that rabbit hole. And I had a lot of research done already, but then I really got into the black dog lore and discovered that, you know, there were black dogs everywhere. You know, they were in they weren't just in Britain. They were in the U.S. and Canada and in the south of the U.S. border. So, but a couple of things led me to Mysteries in the Mist, which is all about fogs and mists and clouds and the paranormal. One of them was a story, or well, not just one, but one of the stories that stands out for me from the Phantom Black Dog book is the one where one of the original editors of the Oxford English Dictionary had taken his family on vacation in the mountains in the UK. They were out hiking, and this mysterious fog rolls in. He's determined, you know, those of us who've done search and rescue work know that when that kind of thing happens, when the visibility is really bad, particularly if you're on a mountainside, probably the best thing to do is just sit down and wait it out. This fellow seems to have been determined to go on. And, you know, a classic black dog appears, blocks his and his family's way and refuses to let them pass, which is a very common behavior for this apparition. You know, it appears out of the fog. So when the fog clears, of course, this gentleman discovers that this this apparition kept them from walking off the cliff. So we saw the guardian aspect of the Phantom Black Dog. So I found that story really interesting. I had also, you know, kind of coincidentally or synchronistically, however you want to put it, been reading some of Linda Godfrey's work, going back through some of her work, and encountered a couple of different cases, which are mentioned in the book, where she had these man-wolf or dog-man-type entities that seemed to be stalking particular areas, farms and ranches. And the farmers or ranchers were putting out trail cams and were getting these anomalous pictures of strange mists. In one case, the gentleman was actually putting out roadkill and, you know, roadkill deer and things like that, and putting trail cameras on them. And often what would happen, or sometimes what would happen, is a mysterious mist would form that would black out part of the picture. And when the mist was gone, so was the roadkill. So that kind of piqued my attention. And the third thing that got me going on mists and fogs and clouds and the paranormal was actually a personal experience that I relate in the introduction to the book. This didn't happen to me. I had a friend who I call Nate in the book, since I haven't seen him for many, many, many years. And I, you know, couldn't actually contact him to get permission to use his name in the book. But this fellow was, you know, one of those people who was a goth before there was such a thing as goths, right? This is back in the 80s. You know, the black clothes, the black eyeliner, the black nail polish, the long mullety type hair, that sort of thing. And, you know, had a predilection for dabbling in aspects of the occult that maybe you should have been dabbling in. So Nate actually told me this, and his girlfriend actually told me this story, that he had gone to bed one night, gone to bed early because he had to go to work the next day, got up in the night to use the restroom, or what we call a washroom here in Canada. And he wandered out into his hallway, and there was a mirror that hung at the end of the hallway. And when he looked at the surface of this mirror, it was covered in fog or mist or a cloud, however you want to call it. And he distinctly recalls feeling compelled to actually enter this mirror. Oh, fortunately, his girlfriend was spending the night with him that night. And something woke her. She came out into the hallway and found him with his face literally plastered against this mirror, trying to get into it. She wrestled him away from the mirror, probably three times, trying to get him away from this thing. And every time she'd let him go, he'd head back toward mirror. Finally got him cognizant enough to get him back into bed and, you know, consider tying him down. But, you know, they passed the night without any further incident. And, but he recalls just feeling that he was being drawn out of his body. into this mirror. So, you know, we had this mist that was mysteriously, you know, who knows, concealing who knows what. And so, you know, as a result, and I would have taken this with a grain of salt because this fellow was not, you know, not known for his sobriety. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
But the girlfriend and he both told the same story, and, you know, B, his behavior changed after this. You know, he got rid of some of those books that were a little questionable and seemed to straighten his act up a little bit. So, you know, whatever it was that happened with this mirror had an effect on him. So I started thinking about that. I started thinking about the Godfrey case. I started thinking about multiple cases of fog in the Phantom Black Dog book, you know, including the one where the fellow, you know, gets chased back into his house and his dad goes up and takes a shot at the dog and ends up ventilating their outhouse. that one happens in the fog too.
Yeah.
But I was looking at these and I got to thinking, you know, there are people out there who have like a checklist of things. You know, if I see these things, then I'm pretty sure something paranormal is going on, you know, and, you know, ranging from, you know, the Jenny Randall's Oz effect things where you have, you know, a time displacement type of phenomena. You have what I call the silence that descends on people when these things happen, and they normally have this feeling that something's about to happen before it actually does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you get those things. And then some people talk about glowing eyes, being a sign of the paranormal. And, you know, there are other things, you know, the presence of black dogs sometimes can be a sign of the paranormal. And I got to thinking, well, I wonder if fog, mist, cloud, that kind of thing could be, you know, another sign that some kind of a paranormal incursion is happening. And when I say paranormal, I'm speaking the broadest sense of the word, of those things that are outside the realm of current scientific explanation, covering the whole realm. So I'm using it in a very broad sense of the word. So I got thinking about that, and I went down the rabbit hole. and this book, Mysteries in the Mist, is the result of that plunge down the rabbit hole.
It is a very strange feeling, fog or mist, Travis, because as a young man, I grew up in a village in Yorkshire, which was near a pit. And one of the things that very rarely happens these days where we live now and where my family still live, is that when I was a child growing up, we would have absolute pea supers. Like fog, you could basically see about 6 foot in. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Primarily because of the amount of pollution in the air that was congregating in the right environment, and the weather was certainly cold and there'd be no wind, and it just dropped on you like you were actually inside a cloud. And I remember many a time as a child walking to and from friends in the winter, and it would be pitch black and the lights would be silhouetting your shadows for what seemed like 100 yards. It was incredible. And it just gives it a very creepy feeling just to normal circumstances. And I think added to the fact that this is also one of the tropes of horror films from since the dawn of cinema and, you know, from the classic Universals, Dracula's castles always sort of shrouded in banks of mist and fog rolling in, and obviously Sherlock Holmes running across the moors, hunting the Hound of the Baskervilles in thick fogs. And obviously you've got certain, like the classic scene in Silver Bullet where the werewolf's lurking underneath that groundhogging fog and taking everybody down in the posse that's come to catch it. I think it's something that for a perfectly normal phenomenon seems to really instill a fear in people. And it's one of those weird phobias that people have. I think it's called homochlomophobia, where people do actually have a real fear of fog or thick mist that goes back centuries, Travis. And I think it just changes your perception of the real world, because to all intents and purposes, it's just water vapor or a bit of dirt or whatever. And yet it just changes your perception of reality into almost as if you are entering into another world.
Right. Well, I think there's a couple of things at work there. One is the fact that we are binocular visual creatures. So anything that limits our vision scares us. Because, you know, there is some, you know, distant mammalian brain back there that recognizes that, you know, fog and visual obscurations can hide predators.
Yes.
You know, in a very real sense. So I think that's one thing that, you know, that we see about fog that makes us, leery. The other thing is fog is a liminal space.
Mm.
It's not rain, but it's not clear either. Mm. So it's in between. Any place that's in between, anything that's in between, has the potential be linked to or to breed paranormal phenomena. And we see this all throughout the book, ranging from, you know, cryptids to UFOs to, you know, to time slips and disappearances. Over and over again throughout this entire book, we see, you know, the fog being associated with these strange phenomena. And I really do believe that has something to do with the liminal nature of fog, the fact that it is in between, and therefore, you know, can tend to breed these kinds of things. If, you know, whether it's a obscuration that's hiding something that's already there, like your werewolf in the Silver Bullet,
yes.
or if the phenomena itself is actually producing it, there's a story in the UFO section of the book where a young lady in Australia, if I recall correctly, is, I believe she was on holiday and she's looking out over the beach and she sees this cloud off in the distance, pretty pink cloud, and she doesn't think much of it. And she looks back about an hour later and the cloud is very close to where she is. And as she watches, this thing comes closer and closer to her, until she's actually looking down on it, and she's looking down on a flying disc that is producing this cloud. What makes this story even more fun is that the disc actually produces a humanoid that comes out onto the beach. And as I recall, it signals with like a flashlight or something, and something off in the distance fires a flare. And it jumps back in the craft and takes off toward where the flare was. And she sees a disturbance out in the water, but she's not sure what it is. You know, and I love this story because, you know, I mean, everybody's, you know, not everybody, but a lot of people are all in on the extraterrestrial hypothesis. You know, we have some advanced civilization flying, you know, spacecraft through light years of space to come here and do whatever it is that they're doing. And then you get a story like this where, you know, basically it's like this craft can't find whoever it is they're looking for. So they have to get out and use a signal flashlight and somebody has to shoot a flare off so they can find each other. You would think that members of an advanced technological civilization would be able to, you know, home in on each other without having to go to that kind of extent to do it. You know, I found that very, very funny, but it's also interesting that this craft was using a cloud as cover. And you have to stop and think, okay, well, how many of the clouds we see out there are actually hiding weird stuff, you know?
Yes.
So I love that story.
Yeah. I recently spoke with Adam Benedict about his latest book, Oddities in Print, and there's a story about a strange cloud in that where someone seems so perturbed by this cloud acting weirdly that they shoot at it, as you do, Travis.
Okay.
And the bullet sticks in the cloud, like on the outside, like in an old cartoon or something, that the bullet just sticks inside. And then the bullet just falls to the ground and the cloud drifts off as though it's like, right, well, I've taken the warning. I'll be on my way then.
Yeah, enough of that. I'm leaving now. It's like the Phantom Black Dog in my other book that the guy shoots at and the bullet comes out of the end of the barrel of the gun and then just falls to the ground.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing about the fog and mist, though, as you touch on in your book, it seems to be across all forms of paranormal phenomenon. As you touched on there, we've got it with UFOs, we've got it with cryptids, we've got it with stories of folklore and the fae, we've got it with phantom black dogs, UFOs, sea monsters. There doesn't seem to be any part of this wonderful topic where you can find a rich selection of stories that feature fog or strange mists appearing.
Yeah, and in a lot of those cases, it's questionable about which came first, the chicken or the egg? Was the strangeness thing there before the mist and produced it, or did the mist come? Or did the mist actually produce the strangeness thing? You know, there's a school of thought amongst esoteric folk and magicians and whatnot that. That spirits, for instance, can use some of these, like incense smoke, for instance, to assume a particular form. So who's to say that there aren't beings out there that can't take their form out of these fogs, mists, and clouds? It's very obvious from, reading some of the man-wolf encounters particularly, that some of these creatures use the fog as cover. Now, whether they're producing the fog or whether the fog is just natural fog and they're using it, is up for debate, but it's pretty obvious that they're using it for cover. But then when you get into the UFO stories, there are several stories in the book where, the UFO almost seems to use the smoke or mist or whatever it is that comes out of it as a form of defense. Is a way of keeping people away from the craft, because the effects of the smoke or mist or whatever it is that's coming out of this craft are noxious, producing symptoms ranging from nausea, eye irritation to black urine and other really awful things, which seem to resolve themselves pretty quickly once you get away from the source. But it almost seems like the UFO is using chemical agents, in the form of mist to keep people at bay. So you see that. And then you have just what I call the whole section called mysterious mists, where you have these clouds and fogs that don't seem to be associated with anything in particular, any other paranormal phenomena, but are the phenomena themselves. Where, I love the story of Mark Henschel there in the UK, who's he's riding his motorcycle. It's summertime, but apparently that summer was cold and wet. And the poor fellow is soaked to the skin. He's riding at night on a motorcycle. That's not the best possible conditions for riding a motorbike. He notices behind him two purple glows in his rearview mirror. He thinks the car is overtaking him. And in fact, a little later on, a Jaguar does come along and starts to pass him. But about that time, he and the motor car both enter a cloud that he describes as a vivid purple with a sort of pink edges to it. As soon as these vehicles enter this cloud, both of them lose power. They both cut out, the classic thing where, suddenly you lose power, the radio goes off and all that stuff, right? The interesting thing about this, though, is that, one, this young man notices that, because he was 16 at the time of the incident, this young man notices that suddenly his thighs and along his back are feeling very warm. He's starting to steam. And at the same time, his bike is being pulled up a hill. He has no power, but whatever it is in this cloud is pulling the bike, his motorcycle, up the hill. And in fact, pulls the motorcycle and the car over the crest of a hill before it dissipates and they regain power. So this young man not only loses the power on his motorcycle, gets pulled up the hill, you know, in an anti-gravity cloud. But when he comes out of the cloud, his riding suit is completely dry, despite having been soaking wet before. So we have no explanation for this, right? There's no, you know, there is no meteorological phenomena that produces that kind of result. No. And that's one of my favorite stories from the book.
Yeah. I have to say there was one that really made me scratch my head, as you say, because I think it's easy to just kind of think of fogs and mists appearing when strange things are going on. There's another story from Australia where there's someone parked at the side of a road and a car comes past and drives into a cloud that seems to be just on the road that basically kills all the power in the car. And it's one of those where something strange, really strange has happened. And yet the person who it's happened to seems to react very matter of fact. Travis, they get out, they're really annoyed that clearly that this has happened. And yet their car seems to be covered in this kind of white substance or whatever. They get out, they clean their windshield, they're really annoyed that whatever's happened. They get back in their car, the car starts off, and they just drive off. They don't say anything.
And they just drive away, yeah. Yeah, I won't even attempt to pronounce the name of this place, but it's something like Namihinga.
Yeah.
It's in Australia. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And the witnesses were actually a couple. And there was another witness, but they didn't get his statement. There was a couple, though, that had stopped at a local sort of convenience store. And they were trying to get directions to, this was back before GPS and so forth. They were trying to get directions to trying to figure out the best way to get to where it was that they were going from where they were. And they happened to be, you know, parked along the side of the road, as you say, as this car comes whirling down the road. They were going to stop this person, and see if they could give them, better directions to you know, on how to get where they wanted to go. And as you say, car drives into a mysterious mist, loses all power and kind of glides to a stop. It's covered in this white detritus, in detritus. We don't know what it was. And this woman gets out of this car, obviously very peeved, you know, cleans off her windshield, and suddenly the car starts back up again. She looks astonished. She jumps back in the car. She drives off like nothing happened. You know, and you wonder if when things like this happen, you know, you still see this sometimes, you know, in other, you know, paranormal type situations where, you know, people have like these, abnormal reactions to things. I talked about it with the phantom black dogs and the people who shoot at them. It's like they never just shoot at the thing once and decide, oh, well, that didn't work. I'm going to go, you know, run away now. They'll stand there and empty their gun.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the people that would walk along next to a phantom black dog and decide that this large, brutish looking dog was just a nice doggy and they were going to pat it on the head. And they go to pat the dog. And their hand goes through the dog, and instead of going, oh, well, maybe I should run away now, they try to bat the dog again and do so several times before they finally decide that they're having a paranormal incursion. So, yeah, I think that, you know, this goes back to the whole idea of shock. You know, we see the same kinds of things happen with people who have traumatic events happen to them. They'll latch on to something and be unable to really function, you know. And I think maybe this is the sort of thing that happens in paranormal incursions. The person's world has been turned upside down all of a sudden. Something really strange has happened to them and they just don't know how to react. So they keep doing whatever it was they were doing. You know, in this case, the woman, you know, drives down the road and probably listening to the radio or whatever and loses out on the whole fact that, you know, I wonder how many paranormal events like this actually just fade from people's memories because they can't deal with them.
Yeah.
They can't even deal with it. So Yeah, that was a great story too, though. Because of the nonchalant kind of matter of fact way, you know, she gets out and brushes off her windshield and looks pissed off and then gets in her car and drives away, you know.
Absolutely. I like the last part
of
that.
That thing happens to me all the time.
I like the last part of that particular story as well, that she's driven off and she's thrown the cloth on the floor that she's cleaned the window with. And the witnesses say that the cloth combusts, it bursts into flame.
Yes, it was a yellow cloth. It wasn't just any cloth. I thought that was an interesting detail. They remembered that it was a yellow cloth that she wipes the windshield off with. She throws it down, drives off, and this thing bursts into flames. Now, it's like, okay, what did she wipe off her car?
Yeah.
which reminds you, I was talking about the young man coming out of this rainstorm and being completely dry after passing through this cloud. There's a ship story where I think the name of the ship was New Day, and it was towing a barge across the Atlantic. And this really dense fog arises in front of them, and they sail into it, and the vessel loses power immediately.
Mm.
And they're trying to, get the engines to restart, and they're going through all the stuff, and their navigational equipment goes wonky. And, so they're in pretty desperate straits until this thing dissipates. And, because they can't see their barge, they can't see the thing they're towing. When the engine finally does come back online, they try to move the vessel off from where it's sitting, but it won't go anywhere. It's like they're anchored until this fog actually dissipates completely, and then it's like the anchor comes up and they begin to move again. Well, the captain sends a party out to check on the barge that they're towing. And the crew report back that everything seems to be in order, except that this other this barge, when they went to board it, the whole thing was extremely warm to the touch.
Mm.
So you have to wonder, you have a combusting rag, we have warm barges, we have people drying out in clouds. It's like, okay, what's going on in these things?
It is strange. I mean, I always have a deep love for stories of the Flying Dutchman as well, because that's some of those stories are saying that it's misty when people are at sea. And to be fair, I don't think there's much truth in the Flying Dutchman. But I have to say, as tales of strange things on the high seas go, Travis, the Dutchman's probably my favorite, because it's so well established, and it seems to have been around for such a long time. And there's also a member of British royalty that claimed to have witnessed it at the end of the 19th century as well, which has kind of given it a bit more credence. But it's one of those that you can't find where it starts. It just starts. And that often would be reported as appearing in a haze or a mist, and it would be glowing. And some people would say it seemed to be glowing green and giving off some strange kind of effervescence that made people attract to it. And when you come to, I think the sea is a strange thing anyway, because often you can get weird weather phenomenons that occur there in challenging circumstances anyway, that would take a troubling situation and just ramp it up when you got a big fog drop on you.
Yeah, well, and just a little teaser for the coming book. If you want ghost ships, there's going to be, several accounts of interesting ghost ship things in this next book that's coming up. But the sea is a mysterious place. We like to think that we know everything there is to know about this planet, but a significant portion of the sea is never, the undersea, the deep sea, has never been explored. Mm. We don't really know what's down there. You have situations that there's a story in the book. Again, you want to talk about fogs and mists and the paranormal. There's a story in the book about the Kosseru, which was a large cargo ship that was traveling off the coast of India. I believe they were headed for Bombay, if I remember correctly.
Hmm.
They encounter a monsoon storm and heavy fog. And, of course, the captain, being ultra cautious, is sounding his horn on a regular basis.
Mm.
and they hear a response in the fog. So they immediately, you know, want to avoid collision. So they cut the engine, and multiple people on this vessel saw another vessel pass to their stern. And it was close enough to where they could see the name of it. It was called the Tricolor.
Mm.
And, you know, this, but the odd thing is that they don't see anybody on the deck. They don't see anybody on the bridge. They don't see anybody on this boat at all.
Mm.
So they're very puzzled by this. The fog clears, and, you know, they estimate the visibility is well out beyond the range where they should be able to see this vessel that passed them. But there's nothing there. You know, they estimate that the visibility was 7 miles, and given the speed that the vessel was going when they saw it, it should be within easy visibility range of them, but there was nothing there. To make this story even creepier, the navigator calls the captain and navigators and so forth, the bridge crew, into the navigation thing, and points out that, they had just passed over a section that was marked on the navigation charts as a shipwreck.
Mm.
And it was the shipwreck of the Tricolor. And they saw the Tricolor precisely 1 year to the date and time after its sinking. It sank as a result of a chemical explosion. So creepy stories of the sea. And there's another one, a U.S. naval destroyer during I don't know if World War II had commenced in the U.S. or not. I'm not sure if this was before or after Pearl Harbor, but it was 1942.
Mm.
It was in the winter, so it may have been shortly after the U.S. declared war on Japan.
Yes, yeah.
I believe the ship's name was Kanesaw, but I could be mistaken there. Patrolling in San Francisco Bay. Looking for Japanese submarines, you know, primitive sonar and radar equipment, you know, from what we have today. But multiple lookouts stationed because, of course, it's San Francisco and it's foggy. I lived in the Bay Area for a year, and I can testify, you talk about pea soup fog. We got it there too. Yeah. It would just, yeah. And it did just fall on you.
Yes.
So the multiple lookouts on this vessel, testified to seeing what appeared to be an old sailing ship, sail by to the stern of this destroyer, but there was no sonar or radar contact. And the vessel appeared from the fog and then disappeared into the fog, and nobody has any idea what it was. So, you know, those sorts of things happen more often at sea than maybe we want to imagine.
Absolutely. And keeping with a watery based theme, I was delighted that one of my favorite monster encounters, and this is another one, as I was touching about the Dutchman, because there are some people who think that this was just a tall tale that was invented. And ironically enough, it's 60 years ago this month since this incident happened, which is the infamous story of Edward Brian McCleary and his four unfortunate friends who decided to go skin diving at Pensacola Bay in Florida.
Yeah.
And it's always struck me as even if it is, you know, a work of fiction, Travis, I still think it's such a scary story anyway, that it's one of those that if there's even a modicum of truth in it, it's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, I included the story, well, first of all, because it had a fog basis to it. It occurs in the fog. But, you know, I mean, yes, the witness does basically go silent after, you know, giving his testimony. And we don't have any way of verifying whether this actually happened or not.
Mm.
We do know from other people's investigations that, you know, that there was a series of deaths in that time period, you know, that were called accidental drownings.
Mm.
But, you know, we don't know. So, I mean, there's something happens to this young man and his group of friends. And what he says happened is that, you know, they were diving a shipwreck off the coast of Florida, as you say. I believe it was an old battleship. And they were in basically a rubber dinghy. and the weather started to go bad. Again, according to this young man's testimony, weather started to go bad. The waves were coming up. Fog came in. They couldn't see a thing, and they were basically trying to paddle their way back to shore, and ended up in the water because this boat was not fit for any kind of rough weather. Long story short, according to Mr. McCleary, some creature came up from the depths of the bay and proceeded to take all of his friends one at a time. And of course, there's the requisite, stories of people screaming and all that kind of fun. But the basic story is that this young man was trying to get back to shore. And, as he and his cohorts were trying to get back to shore, this monster supposedly came up and ate them. And he only supposedly escaped by sheer good luck, apparently. Ended up washed up on shore and had to be rescued, and he ended up in the hospital. So, I mean, something had obviously happened to this young man. Something traumatic had obviously happened to this young man. Now, we don't know, we'll never know, really, what the truth of the matter is. But, think about this. Like I said, there are vast portions of the sea that have never been explored. We don't really know what's down there. We know that they've pulled things like the coelacanth out of the water and, off the coast of South Africa, and that was supposed to have been extinct for umpty million years. Who's to say that, there aren't other relic creatures that have survived, into this age that are producing some of these sea monster stories that we see, or lake monster stories that we see. Yeah, so I'm not ready to shrug off Mr. McCleary entirely. I mean, I think the story has to be taken with a big grain of salt. But something obviously happened, something traumatic obviously happened to this young man. Now, either he did encounter a sea monster that ate all his friends, which certainly would be traumatic, or something else happened that he was so afraid to talk about that he made up a story about a sea monster eating all his friends. What gives me pause is, if you were going to say that something came up and got your friends, why not say that you were attacked by a shark?
Yeah, especially where they were.
Yeah, if you were going to make up a story, the waters off of Florida are infested with the things. It wouldn't be at all beyond the realm of possibility that a group of kids in the water would be attacked by sharks.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if one of them happened to be bleeding from some injury.
Yeah.
Why would he go to the trouble of making up a story about sea monsters?
Yeah.
A sea monster taking his friends when he could have easily, fallen back on the shark explanation.
Hmm.
That gave me pause, thinking about that. So, it's a terrific story.
Yeah.
Whether it's true or not, because it does make you stop and think about, what really, I'm not fond of swimming in the ocean myself.
No, me neither.
I never have been since I was a kid. I was fascinated with sharks when I was younger, and I decided that maybe the ocean wasn't the place for me.
Yes.
That was during my sharks and Loch Ness monster phase, when I was, probably 8 or 9. probably 10 or 11. But anyway, that was before the Bigfoot phase.
Yeah.
I've been a paranormal geek for my entire life, so.
Absolutely. Well, the thing about the sea is that even creatures of myth and legend, there's enough things in there outside of the normal predators such as sharks that can take you down, even just normal fish like, I've seen stories of people who have nearly been killed by groupers that have latched onto them and tried to pull them down, and, squid, killer whales.
Yep.
There's plenty of things. And as you say, I think because it's such an unknown quantity, I'm fully on board in regards to the possibilities of strange things lurking down there that we haven't got the faintest idea. You know, if we can accidentally discover things like the Megamouth shark without looking for mm-hmm. them, you know, just by chance because it decided to take a chunk out of a Japanese film crew's camera, then what else is there? You know, and you only have to look at the stories of the squid and how that was dismissed for decades until they suddenly started turning up, and they are just incredible creatures, and yet we know that there's probably bigger ones out there because we know some of the scarring that we found on sperm whales. So we know mm-hmm. that there are giants down there. We've just never seen them.
Yes, because there's no reason for us to have seen them, because when they die, they probably just sink to the bottom.
Hmm?
You know, I mean, unless there's something that drives them to the surface, there's no reason that human beings would even know they were there.
Hmm.
Because we haven't explored those areas that extensively.
Mm.
I mean, if I were going to, you know, put money on where we might find our next cryptid, you know, the sea is a good place to put your money, because there's all kinds of places for things to hide.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And talking of creepy stories, there is another one, which is slightly on a bit of a tangent from, so I'm going to pull us back in inshore and get on dry land.
Okay, okay.
Though,
let's get back on dry land.
I think it's for the safest, Travis. I've never seen this story before, reading it in your book, and I'm quite surprised, because it's such a creepy tale that when I read it, it reminded me of well-known folk tales and legends that span continents about people that disappear and come back 20, 30 years later, and unfortunately they don't realize it. And it's the story of the gentleman called Dmitry Gershkov.
Yes. Yeah. I love this story. I mean, this was one of those ones that you're like, okay, is this a time slip? Is it, you know, is it a really strong recurrence of residual energy? Is it something, you know, related to the Fae? I mean, because you can have all kinds of theories about this one, but the basic form of the story is that there's a Russian Orthodox priest who's about to close up his church at night, and this young man comes in, or he finds this young man out in the churchyard, having materialized from a fog, of course, a mist. Finds this young man out in the churchyard, and he's hysterical. He's absolutely hysterical. And so the priest, and he's dressed oddly. He's dressed in kind of old, kind of antique, but very sort of formal clothes. So the priest, you know, gets this young fellow to come inside and calms him down a little bit, and gets the story from him that he was supposed to be married that day. And as he made his way into town, he stopped at the local cemetery, at the local graveyard, to pay his respects to a friend who had died that year, which seems a kind of an odd thing to do to me when you're going to your wedding. But, you know, maybe he wanted to talk to his friend about this girl or whatever. We don't really know what his motivation was for stopping in the graveyard, but he reports, you know, to the priest that he actually sees his friend. And then things become really weird, because he leaves the graveyard. And as he's walking into town, he realizes that everything has changed. And by the time he gets to the church, which is where he's supposed to be married, he's hysterical, because none of the houses, none of the buildings, none of the businesses, nothing looks familiar to him. And so the priest is, you know, getting the story out of him. And as he tells the story, he becomes more and more hysterical again. And before the priest can stop him, he runs out the door into this mist again, and he disappears. And the priest is like, okay. So the priest starts to research his parish records, and he finds this young man's name. He finds the story of this young man having disappeared on his way to his wedding some decades earlier. And even more interesting is the young man has appeared to not only this parish priest, but a couple of others. They're in the documents, in the parish records, priests have written out the story of this young man appearing at the church a couple of times before he encountered, before this particular priest encountered him. So not only did the young man appear to this priest after having disappeared for decades, but he has been coming back repeatedly, trying to find his way back to whatever time it is he came from, apparently. Because he's always like puzzled, he's always hysterical, and he's always looking to find his bride and get married and do the stuff that he was supposed to do that day. It's just a really, really odd story, and there's no good explanation for it. Because, you know, like I say, is this fellow stuck in a recurring time loop where he keeps living this over and over again? You know, did he in some way or the other die? And because of the strong emotion attached to his wedding, he's appearing as a residual energy over and over again? Because the story is pretty much the same every time a priest encounters him. You know, he finds this hysterical person in the churchyard. He brings them into the church. He gets the story out of them. The story is pretty much the same every time. And then he goes running out of the door and it disappears into the mist again. You know, so is it a residual energy thing? Is it one of those situations like in fairy lore where, you know, he accidentally wandered into the other world and he comes back only to find that everything is different? So maybe he goes back into the other world trying to find his way back to the time he belongs. We just don't know. We can theorize about this one all day long, but we're never going to solve it because, you know, there's just too many different things that could be going on there. But it's a fascinating story because, I mean, you have all of these encounters documented by these priests in the parish records. And I mean, why on earth would they do that unless something actually happened?
Absolutely. There are lots of strands to this story that make it a bit peculiar, as you say, because he appears in a mist, he disappears in a mist. It's a reoccurring event. And when I was reading it, it reminded me, because I think obviously the most famous kind of time slip story most people will be aware of outside of fairy lore is probably Rip Van Winkle.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The gentleman that goes off to the mountains and comes back several decades later and once again realizes he thinks he's been asleep for an hour. And it's 50 years or whatever that's passed, and everybody that he knew and loves either very old or they've all passed on. And it's an unusual story because it doesn't really seem to have any sort of parameters when you look at myths and legends and things like that, especially in the area where it is, out in, you know, in Russia, that people would have this kind of story. And like you say, there doesn't seem to be any kind of moral point to it. We don't know if this chap's been bad and he's been punished. It's just that he's stopped to see his friend on the way to his wedding. And then the next thing he knows, time has moved on and everything he knew has disappeared. It's very peculiar.
It is. And like you say, I mean, those kinds of stories are not super common outside the realm of fairy lore.
Mm.
And the Russians, of course, have their own spirits of the land, too. But I'm not familiar enough with their folklore to know whether or not they have the same kinds of, incidences that people in the Celtic lands had, where, you know, someone would be drawn into fairy and think they were gone for 7 days or whatever, and they were gone for 7 years or some other extended period of time, or where, you know, an individual comes out, is granted permission from the fairy queen to come back and visit relatives, but is told not to put feet on the ground. And, you know, whatever, for whatever reason he does, and he dissolves into dust because he's hundreds of years old.
Yes. Yeah.
So we don't know, you know, what the Russian folklore is, but the story itself is just peculiar because there's no good explanation for why this would keep happening. And no good explanation why these priests would keep lying about it if it's a hoax.
Yeah. Yeah, and why does he keep going to the same church? What does the church have to do with it?
No, apparently it's where he was supposed to be married.
But it's weird that he goes back to there. That's the point where he vanishes, because obviously I don't know. It's a remarkable story. It's incredible. And as we talk about peculiar cases, another one that I remember reading several years ago, Travis, and that's always made me chuckle, is the encounter of Hans Gustafsson and Stig Rydberg, and what they described as being attacked by jelly bags that came out of some kind of mist.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a UFO story. You know, these guys are out, they were out skiing, as I recall. Yeah, they were out skiing, and they encounter this craft. Maybe they weren't skiing; they were actually in a car. I'm thinking of another story that involves skiers, but same kind of scenario. But these guys actually saw this craft as they were driving, and they pulled over to the side of the road and went to see what this was. And these jelly bags came out and tried to take them on board this craft. Well, one of them slips the jelly bags and runs away. And the hysterical image in this story is that the other fellow has grabbed onto a fence post and these jelly bags are trying to pull his craft. So he's out kind of horizontally. You know, you picture this as almost like a cartoon, right? These jelly bags are trying to drag him. He's out horizontally from this fence post, hanging on for dear life, trying to keep these things from taking him away, right? Which kind of, you know, I'm sure it's very serious to them, but it makes me laugh. And the scenario is broken up when the other fellow who got away runs back to the car, jumps in and starts honking the horn. And this apparently scares the jelly bags to the point where they leave the other fellow alone and run off and back into their ship and take off. This is another one of those stories that makes me wonder about the whole extraterrestrial thing for a couple of reasons. One is, don't you think that an advanced civilization that is capable of, you know, traveling between the stars would actually have a better way of getting people on board its ship than having jelly bags come out and try to drag them on board physically? I mean, you know, we see other abduction scenarios where, you know, people are floated out and, you know, floated into the ship on floating gurneys or whatever.
Yeah.
But jelly bags trying to drag you onto the ship, that seems a little odd. The other thing that gave me pause about this story is that the description that these guys give of these entities exactly matches something that a teacher of mine told me, an esoteric teacher of mine told me once about astral parasites. This fellow, who's since passed on, told me that there are certain beings on what they call the lower astral plane, which would be very close to the plane that we live on. These beings exist on emotion, and particularly negative emotions.
Mm.
And so they can frequently be found in places like what we call a dive bar, you know, in the U.S., a seedy bar, I guess you call it.
Yep.
A place where people go who are depressed and you know, are drinking their troubles away, that kind of place.
Mm.
These beings can be found in those kind of places because the alcoholics that are drinking there tend to have what you might call a tattered aura and are easy targets for these things.
Mm.
But he described them exactly like the beings that come out of this craft. They're kind of this amorphous blob-like jelly-filled thing that, you know, if you have the second sight clairvoyance, you can actually see them. You know, and this is one of the reasons that he gave for not ever going into bars like that. Didn't want to encounter one of these things. You know, they're harmless to people who are, you know, in good mental, emotional state, but they're parasitic. They're basically parasites. So, you know, I couldn't help but remember those things when I was reading the description of these jelly bags and wondering, okay, well, this not maybe some kind of an elaborate scenario for these things to feed off of these two men's fear, you know, because obviously, you know, if something's trying to drag you into a place that you don't want to go, you feel you're being abducted, it's going to produce some negative emotions. So something that occurred to me as I was reading the thing. But in and of itself, the story is hilarious because you just have this picture of this poor guy on the fence post all these things are trying to drag him into this ship. I'm glad that his friend was able to get him loose from that.
Yeah, not as much as he probably was, Travis, I suspect.
I'm sure, yeah.
And I think the last case I'd like to touch on before we let you return to the safety of inside, away from fogs and mists, is a very interesting sort of, some people might claim it's a UFO case, some may say it's an alien abduction, some may say it's a time slip, which is about the Day family. And this occurred whilst they were driving in Averley in Essex in 1974. And this is one of those situations where you think, if I'm driving along a road, Travis, and a green mist appears, I don't think I'd drive through it. I'd think, hang on. Now maybe that's because I've read plenty of weird stories and heard strange encounters and looked into these things that makes me think whenever things like this occur, then you pause for thought. But as we've been saying about some of these cases, people have some very unusual reactions to very strange occurrences, and maybe that they just thought, that's a bit strange, but driving into it is only the beginning of their problems.
Yes, just to back up for a minute, the green mist appears all throughout this book. And one of the things that I note in the section on fairy lore is that green mist is actually associated with the Fae in more than one textual reference. So, you know, we have a situation where these people are driving along, they're happily going wherever it is that they're going. They're singing Beatles tunes in the car to entertain themselves.
Yeah.
But yeah, this whole thing of colored mist, fog is fog, you know, and you see fog and you think, well, you know, that's kind of creepy, but that's okay. I'll tell you what, if I ever see a fog that's any kind of a color, whether it's black or purple or green or yellow or pink, I am going to as weird stuff happens when you come in contact with these things. In this case, this family drives through this mist. You know, they have a distinct Oz effect kind of experience while they're in the mist, the silence descending and so forth, you know, in the definite sense that something's going on, that, you know, time is not what it ought to be. And when they come out of this thing, they are several miles down the road from where they should be, according to their watches, and they've lost something like 2 hours. Now, again, like, as you say, alien abduction. Well, you know, I mean, those kinds of scenarios have happened out of cars before.
Mm-hmm.
Something to do with the Fae. It's in England, primary fairy country.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly plenty of fairy stories over on that side of the dock. And, you know, we have plenty of them on this side of the sea, too. I've just been discovering about fairy lore in Nova Scotia and Newfoundland, for instance. And it's quite interesting, too. You know, could be a time slip, you know, a situation where they just lost time. Again, we can theorize all we want to, and everybody has a pet theory. You know, I mean, you know, all of the UFO abduction people want it to be a UFO abduction, and all the people like me who are into fairy lore are like, oh, that could be a fairy abduction, and all the people who are into the whole quantum physics time slip thing want it to be a time slip. But the fact is, we don't know what happened to those folks, but we do know that something really weird happened when they drove through a colored mist. So my advice to all of your listeners is if you see a colored mist, go the other direction. unless you just really want something weird to happen to you. I mean, there are some people out there that would probably run right into it because they think, oh, this would be cool. Just remember that you could end up like that poor fellow, the Grishkov kid who ends up, you know, in a time loop. So, you know, it's one of those you pays your money, you take your chances kind of things if you go into one of these things. And, you know, I should note, too, that frequently these mists have a noxious effect on human beings and can cause health problems and so forth. If you decide to run into the colored mist, you're taking your chances. But, yeah, so, but the Averley story was, yeah, it's it's just strange because we have no way of knowing really what happened to these folks.
Yeah, well, the book is chock full of strange stories. And as you say, it's a real guide on what colors to avoid and turn tail and get out there very quickly. There doesn't seem to be any stories in here where people are enveloped by clouds and have and win the lottery the week after or something like that.
No.
So yes,
no, it's almost always something bad. You know, you might get knocked off your surfboard by a pterodactyl, but you're not going to win the lottery. That's in there. It's in the flying things section.
Well, there's a strange one. I mean, what?
Yeah, this young fellow was a devoted surfer, so much so that they rose that morning and had to knock the ice off their wetsuits before they could get them on.
Oof.
And yeah, so they paddled out into the water on their surfboards. They were in about 7 feet of water waiting for a good wave to come in and ride back to shore. And of course, the mysterious fog descends. And this young fellow claims that he saw a pterosaur knock him off his surfboard. And there were several of them. It seems like there were three or four that he saw or claims to have seen. You know, the classic bat wings with the head ridge behind and the long beak and the whole schmear. I mean, you know, this is, he claims he saw a dinosaur flying along the coast of Oregon. Appeared out of the fog, disappeared into the fog. Nobody else saw them. Even his surfing buddy didn't see them. But something came along and knocked him off his surfboard, and that's what he says he saw. And you have to wonder, you know, again, was this a time slip? Did he suddenly go into this fog and suddenly encounter creatures from another era? You know, is there a relic group of pterosaurs living off the coast of Oregon? Did he have a spontaneous psychic experience? We don't know. There's all kinds of theories about how that could have happened, but the fact is that he swears up and down that he saw a pterosaur. So,
well, if it's the time of the pterosaur, I think that would be the least of his concerns. I'd be more worried about what was underneath the water going on, what we were talking about.
Yeah, I'd be more worried about one of those giant, what do they call, mosasaurs, you know, the giant crocodilian things coming up and having me for lunch.
Yeah, that's before we even get to the megalodon.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I think even that just proves we're best staying in the house, I think, for the foreseeable future whenever there's a fog or a mist about. Travis, like I say, it's a wonderful collection, and as we've mentioned, there are some real harks to some great investigators of the past, Jenny Randall, Janet Board, people like Corliss. You know, there are a lot of people who perhaps have fallen out of favour in regards to paranormal research and ufology and things like that. And I think it's always excellent when you get a new book such as yours, Travis, that you pay fair due to the people that have gone before you and the cases that they've investigated. And I think one of the great aspects of your book is it's a really good jumping off point to go and find out about some authors and some investigators that probably don't get the credence they deserve these days.
Well, yeah, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. There are, you know, there's this whole cult of John Keel out there, you know, and Keel is definitely a writer that people who are interested in these sort of things need to explore. But he wasn't the only one. You know, I cut my teeth when I was a kid on, you know, the books of Frank Edwards, for instance, who was wrote Stranger Than Science and Strange World and a couple of other, you know, books of, you know, basically Fortean phenomena. He covered everything from spontaneous human combustion to UFOs. It was in there. Nobody pays any attention to those writers anymore. Janet and Colin Board, you know, alien animals, like I was saying to you when I was when we were talking before the show, one of the classics in the field.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic book, you know, and if you can find a copy of it nowadays, it's well worth the read. You know, I think I must have, I found a copy, but I think I probably first encountered it in the library. Janet Board's work on real encounters with the fae or the fairy. Excellent work. William Corliss, I talked to him, talk about his work with low-lying auroras as a fog type phenomena in the book. And cite him in a couple of places. There are multitudinous, and all you need to do is look at the bibliography for my book. There's just tons of references in there. And I tell you where the stories come from throughout the book. So you never have a question about, you know, you can go and look it up and say, oh, that was in this book. I want to read this book.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to do that. I enjoy collecting and collating these stories and writing them up and so forth. But, you know, I definitely encourage people to go back and look at some of these older texts too, because there's some classic stories. I would have never found that story that you're talking about, the time slipping Russian kid, if I hadn't been reading some of Brad Steiger's old stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys, some of these people are still around.
Mm.
And some of them are not, or have gotten out of the business for whatever reason. But there's some great references out there that can be explored, that should be explored, that I don't think are getting the attention that they should be getting now. You know, and the paranormal is so apt to fads. You know, it's like, okay, well, we're going to read this writer, and nobody else knows anything about anything. So I encourage people that hear this to go out and look at some of these writers that were writing back in the 60s and 70s, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. Mm. There's some good stuff out there. You just have to look for it.
Absolutely. It still amazes me sometimes, Travis, when I talk to people about who have a deep interest in ghosts and things, and they've never heard of Peter Underwood or John and Anne Spencer.
Holder.
Yeah, and you just, like you say, I think sometimes people think that paranormality or the investigation of it began with cable television or reality ghost hunting shows like we had here in the UK, and there was obviously a massive spate of them in the US and Canada as well.
And
somebody like Peter Underwood, he wrote 15-20 books on the paranormal, covering all aspects and counties and certain types of hauntings, and yet I think most modern lovers of the genre don't even know who Peter Underwood was. And that's a real shame, because, as you say, these people deserve our respect, because we will only learn by looking backwards as well as forwards. And I think by doing that, it gives us a bigger perspective and a wider scope of information and cases that we can look into. And I think it's what we need to do.
Yep. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you there. There's just no question that, I'm quite happy to go browsing through, you know, some of the old Society for Psychical Research stuff too. Mm. I mean, there's some incredible stories in some of those books. I mean, I haven't had enough of an opportunity to delve into them to really include some of that stuff in my work, but I expect it's going to happen at some point.
Yeah. Once you start with those, though, you just think, well, why is this case not famous? Why is that case not famous? What's going on here? So it's,
exactly.
That's another rabbit hole that you might not have time for currently.
I'll figure something out.
Oh, well, Travis, thank you as always, my friend. Where can everybody get a copy of the book and find out what you're up to next?
Well, as always with the Beyond the Fray publishing stuff, our stuff is available on Amazon. It's available either in paperback or in Kindle format. And it should be available on Kindle Unlimited if you have that. If you want to know what's going on with me, I'm available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can find me on Facebook under Will Watson, or I have a W.T. Watson author page. My Twitter handle is at WTWatson2. And my Instagram is a little strange. It's Couronier, Couronier60. But that's me. It's an old handle that I was using a while back that I've dusted off for the whole author thing. So I'm happy to hear from people. I love, you know, getting interaction with readers. I've had a couple of people write me with stories that I hope to include in the book someday. But happy to hear from people, you know, stories you want to hear about, you know, other things you want to investigate. I'm always open to suggestions about writing stuff. So I will look forward to hearing from some folks.
Fantastic. And I know you touched on your next project. So can you give us a brief synopsis of where you're going next, my friend?
Well, I'm still in the early research phases, but I'm doing a another project for Beyond the Fray that will focus on Canada monsters and lore of Canada, because I think that's there have been some Canadian writers that have done a pretty good job of covering the mysteries in Canada, but I don't think that it's really gotten out to a wider sort of U.S. audience. So I'm living here now, and I'm anxious to find out more about the strange things that exist in my new home base. So doing a pretty deep dive on a number of topics in Canada. So that's where I'm headed now.
Fantastic. I look forward to that. Travis, as always, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure as always. I wish you the very best of luck with the book, and hopefully we will speak again sometime.
I'm sure we will, Paul. I really appreciate your time and hope to hear from your listeners on social media.